Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Free Speech Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 18, 2015, the Supreme Court issued two highly anticipated decisions in free speech cases, Walker v. Texas Division, Sons of Confederate Veterans, Inc., and Reed v. Town of Gilbert. Walker v. Texas Division, Sons of Confederate Veterans, Inc., concerned two First Amendment issues. The first was whether content displayed on specialty license plates issued by the state is government speech, immune from First Amendment prohibition on viewpoint discrimination. The second was whether Texas engaged in viewpoint discrimination when it rejected a specialty license plate design which included an image of a Confederate flag. In an opinion delivered by Justice Breyer, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that Texas's specialty license plate designs constitute government speech, and Texas was therefore entitled to reject the design proposed by Sons of Confederate Veterans. The decision of the Fifth Circuit to the contrary was reversed. Justices Thomas, Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined Justice Breyer's majority opinion. A dissenting opinion was filed by Justice Alito, joined by Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia and Kennedy. Reed v. Town of Gilbert involved a First Amendment challenge to the sign code for Gilbert, Arizona, which imposes more stringent restrictions on signs directing the public to meetings of nonprofit groups, including churches, than on other signs. By a vote of 9-0, the court reversed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit, which had rejected the challenge, and remanded the case. Justice Thomas, joined by the Chief Justice and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Alito, and Sotomayor, held that the code's sign provisions were content-based restrictions of speech that could not survive strict scrutiny. Justice Alito also filed a concurring opinion, joined by Justices Kennedy and Sotomayor. Justice Breyer filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. Justice Kagan, joined by Justices Ginsburg and Breyer, also filed an opinion concurring in the judgment. To discuss the case, we have Professor Eugene Volokh, the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at the UCLA School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Volokh.
The first case that I'll talk about is the Reed v. Town of Gilbert case. This involves a sign ordinance. Now, many cities have ordinances, some states have statutes, that limit size of signs, the location of signs. And the theory behind those laws, and incidentally there's also a federal statute along these lines as well, is that signs cause visual clutter. They're aesthetically unappealing. They interfere with the enjoyment of the scenery. And they're also distracting to drivers. In fact, signs only work if they attract the driver's attention. And when the driver's attention is on the sign, it's not on the road in front of him. Now, some of these ordinances are limited to commercial signs. And it's probably the case that restriction on commercial advertising, because of the commercial speech doctrine, would be generally permissible in this kind of context. There are some interesting twists with that. Let's set that aside, and let's focus on restrictions on signs that are not commercial, that are political, religious, and the like. Some places restrict these signs in a way that is genuinely content neutral. So they may say, look, you can't have signs larger than this size, no matter what is on the sign. And that would usually be constitutional as a permissible content-neutral time, place, and manner regulation. But quite a few places have restrictions that have certain kinds of exceptions. For example, for historical landmark signs, or just generally categorized signs based on their subject matter. Presumably in the theory that some signs are especially valuable, and therefore there ought to be more latitude for them. The town of Gilbert in Arizona, in particular, split up non-commercial signs into three categories. There were political signs, basically campaign-oriented signs, which could be quite large, but had to be taken down not long after the election. There were other ideological signs, which express other viewpoints and other issues, which could be large but couldn't be as large as the political signs. Those, however, could be up indefinitely. And then there were temporary event signs. If you wanted to put on some event, you could put up a sign, but you had to put it up 12 hours before the event, take it down at 1 hour after the event, and the sign itself could only be much, much smaller than the other signs. The city said, look, we're not actually trying to suppress any bad ideas. We're not engaged in viewpoint discrimination here. We're not hostile to events or to ideology. We just want to provide a bit more latitude for, say, political campaign signs, or for ideological signs than for other signs. Then the Ninth Circuit, by a 2-1 vote, upheld that, concluding that because the city had lacked a bad motivation, lacked any desire to suppress speech, the ordinance should be viewed as content neutral and therefore constitutional. And that's what the Supreme Court agreed to consider in Reed v. Town of Gilbert. When these kinds of ordinances should be treated as content neutral, even when on their face they drew distinctions based on content. The Supreme Court has long said that content-based restrictions, with a few exceptions, are presumptively unconstitutional. The question is, what counts as a content-based restriction? And in this case, by a 9-0 vote, the court struck down this restriction. And the justices all agreed it should be viewed as content-based. But there was a substantial disagreement between six justices who signed on to the majority opinion and then three justices who concurred only in the judgment. The six justices in the majority, which was written by Justice Thomas, were basically the conservatives, joined by Justice Sotomayor. Interestingly, the same makeup as in the Sorrell v. IMS Health case, which also involved a content discrimination question, involved a speech about doctors' pharmaceutical prescription practices. But in any event, somewhat unusual lineup. But the majority position was, look, if a restriction is facially content-based, if the government distinguishes among speech based on what it communicates, then that is presumptively unconstitutional. That's subject to strict scrutiny, again, setting aside the usual exceptions for libel and obscenity and the like. And that is that if the restriction is facially content-based. We don't look to whether the government has a benign motive and then reclassify the restriction as content-neutral instead. Once it's facially content-based, it is content-based. Now, if the restriction is facially content-neutral, it might still be found to be content-based if it turns out that the government adopted the law because of disagreement with the message that the speech conveyed. But for a facially content-based law, that's the end of the story, at least as far as the inquiry into whether the law is content-based or not goes. And that made this a very easy case. This restriction was content-based. It failed strict scrutiny. That's that. Now, interestingly, there was a concurrence by three of the justices who joined in the majority. So it was a concurrence just to express their separate views. And part of this concurrence simply said, look, we just want to make clear that certain kinds of content-neutral restrictions are just fine. For example, restrictions on size, location, lighting, changing messages on electronic signs, and the like. So they wanted to stress that cities shouldn't say, oh, now we can't regulate signs at all. Sure, you can regulate them, the concurrence said, just you have to regulate them in a content-neutral way. But then the concurrence gave two other examples, which actually seem to be content-based under the majority's test, which, recall, those concurring justices actually claimed to endorse. By the way, the concurrence was by Justice Alito, joined by Kennedy and Sotomayor. The examples they gave are rules distinguishing between on-premises and off-premises signs. That's a pretty common kind of sign restriction, which says, for example, that if a business wants to advertise itself, it's free to do that, but if it wants to promote other things, essentially to sell space on its sign to other businesses or ideological entities, then that's not permitted. So those restrictions are common, but they're pretty clearly content-based under the majority's view. They distinguish signs based on what is on the sign, whether what is on the sign is related to the business or not. And yet the concurring justices said, well, that's content-neutral. Another example they gave is rules imposing time restrictions on signs advertising a one-time event. Well, again, that's viewpoint-neutral, but it is content-based under the majority view. This suggests that the majority opinion sort of gives, and then the concurrence from three of the justices who signed on to the majority opinion and whose votes were necessary to make a majority now takes away. So the majority opinion is broadly restrictive of content-based restrictions, that is to say, which says, generally speaking, content-based restrictions are unconstitutional, but maybe it's not quite that broad if lower courts end up following the concurrence rather than the majority. I'll only briefly talk about the concurrences in judgment just because they lost, and I want to focus more on the practical implications of this case. Justice Kagan, joined by Justice Breyer and Ginsburg, basically said, look, this hostility to content-based restrictions is often wise, but is actually somewhat overstated. Maybe we are condemning content-based restrictions too sharply. Maybe there should be more room for certain kinds of content-based restrictions that look like they're not really likely to interfere with public debate much at all. And one example she gave is one that we mentioned earlier, which has to do with signs indicating some historical landmarks and such. What's so bad about saying, look, you can't generally have large signs except for signs indicating historical landmarks? Where's the harm to public debate in that? The implications of the majority position is that, hey, that's content-based, that's unconstitutional, end of story. So that's part of what the debate was about. There are two important possible implications for the future that are worth mentioning, in addition to this uncertainty about the full scope of the majority opinion that I mentioned a little earlier. One has to do with the so-called erogenous zoning cases, the cases in which the court upheld zoning restrictions on pornographic bookstores and movie theaters. In those cases, and in some other cases, the court articulated what is called the secondary effects doctrine, the theory that even a facially content-based law could be constitutional if it doesn't really target the primary effects of the speech, its persuasiveness or its offensiveness or the harms that flow from that, but secondary effects, like, for example, the possible diminished property values that come when an adult bookstore opens up in a neighborhood, or possibly extra crime from people attracted to the neighborhood as a result. Well, those laws are exactly what the court seems to be condemning in its majority opinion. Those decisions. They're decisions that, like the Ninth Circuit decision below, said, hey, here's a facially content-based law, but we're going to treat it as content-neutral because it has a good motivation behind it. In fact, if anything, the motivation behind the law was a lot more suspect in those cases, even though the court concluded that the motivation wasn't really hostile to the underlying speech. Now, on the one hand, those were cases, there's a pretty substantial line of those secondary effects cases, and Justices Scalia and Thomas, who joined the majority in this case, supported those cases, often voted in the majority in those cases. And there's nothing in the court's opinion that mentions those cases. I don't think it's trying to overrule those cases. At the same time, those cases are very hard to reconcile with this hard line, if it's facially content-based, then it's content-based position that the majority took. The one other thing I want to mention about this is a case that might be on the minds of some of you already, which is Hill v. Colorado. Recall that back in 2000, the Supreme Court upheld as content neutral a state law that barred people from approaching within 8 feet of patrons of healthcare facilities, hospitals, or most often abortion clinics, for purposes of education or counseling or oral protest. And the majority in that case said, well, that's really a content-neutral law because it's counseling, education, oral protest on any kind of issue, although practically it would almost always be abortion. And Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy sharply dissented, said, this is ridiculous. This is clearly a content-based law. When a law focuses on oral protest, education, or counseling, it's focusing on speech of a particular kind of content. Even if it were viewpoint-neutral, which they were skeptical about, the law is content-based. Well, how is that consistent with a majority opinion here? It turns out the majority opinion, when it cites Hill, it only cites the dissents and approvingly cites the dissents in Hill. So I think it's pretty likely that the Colorado law will be challenged again. And while Hill is not expressly overruled in this case, I think lower courts may well uphold the Colorado law. But then I think there will be another challenge brought before the Supreme Court saying, look, the Reed decision casts doubt, in fact, should be seen as invalidating the Colorado law and overruling Hill. So, potentially an important case with a lot of implications. How broad the implications are is not completely clear, but a pretty firm reaffirmation by the majority of the principle that content discrimination is generally unconstitutional. And the first question in any content discrimination issue is, what does the law say on its face? It's not the motivation of the legislature. If the law is facially content-based, then it should be treated as content-based. So that's Reed v. Town of Gilbert. Now, on to Walker v. Sons of Confederate Veterans. Texas decided to raise money by having a specialty license plate design program. So pretty much any group can say, we want a particular design that our members and supporters could then buy. And we'll basically pay about $8,000 up front to the state as an advance on whatever income it might get from people who actually buy those plates. So it's a fundraising measure for the state of Texas, and for organizations, it's a way of spreading their ideas, and for drivers, it's a way of saying, hey, I support this group. Well, Along comes the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and they want to have a license plate of their own, which includes the Confederate battle flag. No, 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 says Texas. We don't want that. That's too likely to be offensive. Interestingly, Texas allowed a Choose Life license plate. It allowed a Trophy Hunters Association license plate, other kinds of controversial plates, but not Sons of Confederate Veterans. The question in this case was whether this license plate program is a sort of non-public forum or limited public forum, in either of which viewpoint discrimination is forbidden, or whether this program should be treated as government speech, like, for example, monuments that the government puts up or allows to be put up in a park, which is a program where the government can discriminate based on viewpoint. The government can say, we'll take a monument honoring Martin Luther King Jr., but we won't take a monument honoring Bull Connor, let's say. Likewise, the state was saying, we can say we'll take a particular license plate design that expresses a viewpoint that we favor, or at least don't oppose, but we'll reject license plate designs that we disapprove of, because after all, it's our license plate issued by the state of Texas and is therefore government speech. And the Supreme Court held by a 5-4 vote that this is indeed something that should be treated as government speech. That's something that relates to the monument issue that I mentioned. There was a case called Pleasant Grove versus Summum several years ago, in which the court upheld a city's decision to allow certain monuments and not other monuments, and pointed to three major factors, which both the majority and the dissent talk about. One is whether this is a medium that historically has been used by the government to speak to the public. So monuments, the court has said, monuments and parks are generally a way for the government to honor particular people or causes or ideas. Likewise, the majority said, license plates historically have been used to disseminate state-created slogans. It's only recently, in the last few decades, that states have opened them up to private organizations as a revenue-raising measure. On the other hand, the dissent says, well, no, 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 the right history to look at isn't the history of all license plates, but rather precisely the history of specialty license plates. And once you look at that, you see that, in fact, they have indeed been open to the public to speak rather than open for the government to speak. A second factor that the majority pointed to is whether the materials are closely identified in the public mind with the state. And the court says, look, this is a license plate that says Texas. It's issued by Texas. Everybody knows it's issued by the state government. People are going to associate it with the state and view it as having the imprimatur of the state. And the dissent said, ha, that makes no sense at all. This is Justice Alito writing. The example he gave is you sit by the highway and you look at the license plates. And there come various license plates. One says, rather be golfing. That's one design that's out there. Do you think, ooh, that's the official policy of the state? Better to be golfing than working? Or there's another one that has a University of Texas license plate. Well, you might say, well, that is the state policy. But there's another one that has an Oklahoma State license plate or a Notre Dame license plate. Well, do you think, oh, Texas also endorses Notre Dame? You don't. The dissent, reasonably people wouldn't actually view these kinds of license plates as closely identified with the state. Then the third summum factor was whether the government maintains control over the selection of the speech. And the majority says, well, yes, it does. In fact, the government has rejected a few such plates and still reserves ultimate control. And the dissent said, well, in fact, this is a program in which overwhelming majority, nearly all of the many dozens of applications are approved, and therefore, really, this isn't the kind of selectivity that, say, with a National Endowment for the Arts or some other genuinely selective programs may authorize a finding that this is the government actually speaking. So what's happening here is that there are these factors for determining what's government speech and what's not. They're pretty mushy factors. The majority in the dissent takes a very different view about how to apply them, and it's not like this case really clarifies how to apply them in the future. Now, so that's basically the shape of the opinions here. But let's look to the future. What are the implications of this case? So the first thing that we have to recognize is, on its own terms, the case is a case about next to nothing. For the simple reason that now that the Sons of Confederate Veterans can't have this license plate, what can they do? they can get a bumper sticker. They can get a bumper sticker, attach it to their car, anybody who supports a sense of Confederate veterans. It will be cheaper than a specialty license plate. It will be could be larger, could be more visible, could be more flexible, and there are many more designs and more detailed designs that could be used. Really, as a practical matter, this decision doesn't have much of an effect on public debate at all. And I think that has to be acknowledged, whether you like the majority opinion or not. But the real question is, what do you do about the many other kinds of government-private speech partnerships, in a sense, which do matter a lot more? Let's take an example, the charitable tax exemption and the deductibility of charitable tax contributions. Should that be treated as a kind of a limited public forum in which the government can't discriminate based on viewpoint, which is the current understanding? Or could it be seen as a form of government speech, whereby giving somebody tax-exempt status, the government is putting its imprimatur on that speaker and therefore should be able to say, nope, we're not going to give tax-exempt status to allegedly racist groups or anti-gay groups or whatever else. What about student loans? Could there be viewpoint-based conditions attached to them? And here's the one other example, which turns out, I think, to be very practically relevant because it's being litigated right now. What about trademarks? There is, of course, a hot dispute right now with the Redskins as to whether the federal government, whether the Patent and Trademark Office, should cancel, as in fact the lower court has held to be the case, should cancel the Redskins mark on the grounds that it's disparaging to American Indians. Now, there's a controversy as to whether it is or isn't, but the federal statute does specifically say that marks that disparage a person or a group are not registrable. And that's been used to deny registration to Redskins. It's been used to deny registration to, for example, the mark Stop the Islamization of America on the grounds that that mark was disparaging towards Muslims. Also was used to deny registration to a group, an Asian American rock group called The Slants, on the grounds that The Slants is a pejorative term for Asians, even though, of course, this is an Asian group who's trying to kind of reclaim the term for themselves. Well, if you look at the trademark laws, you might view the trademark, registered trademark status, as a kind of government-provided benefit to a particular group of speakers. And then the question is, do we treat this as a non-public forum or limited public forum in which viewpoint discrimination is forbidden, including discrimination against allegedly bigoted viewpoints? Or do we view this as a form of government speech on the grounds that the government is putting its imprimatur on trademarks, the government is putting them on the government-run principal trademark register, the government is allowing you to attach the little TM symbol or the little R with a circle symbol that was created by the government to those marks, in which case the government could discriminate based on viewpoint. Sounds familiar? That's the very issue that was involved in Sons of Confederate Veterans, but here one in which a lot is at stake. And Sons of Confederate Veterans, practically very little was at stake because if you can't put it on a license plate, you can put it on a bumper sticker. In the trademark context, potentially a lot is at stake because there's no really quite as good substitute for having a registered trademark. In fact, the Slants case, which has the name In re Tam, is now pending before the Federal Circuit. So if you want to see the first case in which Sons of Confederate Veterans is going to be argued about, at least in a practically important way, outside the license plate context, it turns out, I'm pretty certain, it's going to be the trademark context. Sounds very different. Trademarks, license plate, designs, we generally don't think of them together, but structurally, the issue is really quite similar. It'll be interesting to see how it'll come out. I think that the Slants should win, and I think the Redskins should win as well, and I think that should happen even after Sons of Confederate Veterans. I think the trademarks are basically not seen by the public as a form of government speech. They're not directly associated with the state's name on a state-provided license plate. But it is pretty clear that this case is going to be argued about in the Federal Circuit litigation, and that in some measure this case does kind of help the government in situations where it wants to support its viewpoint-based partnership programs on the grounds that this is government speech and the government can pick and choose what to endorse.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. for more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.